Turkey, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Alrighty then. It's about a minute past the hour as we begin this Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room and join in with the in the frolicking with the likes of Anatole and Jug of Punch and Labor Man and Soapbox Geezer and Tim from L.A., all capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, though he is a third-stage guild navigator, has elected not to fold space for a while now because apparently it got up around 99 degrees in Northern California today. Yeah. And good evening, Will in Chicago. Good evening, Trey. Welcome to the program. And welcome to you if you would choose to, if you would happen to choose to jump into the conversation there. Just go to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, pick out a go to chat room, pick out a screen name, pick out a password, and well, you'll be right in there in the midst of the madcap merriment that is the multimedia real-time extravaganza that happens between 6 and 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time every Monday through Friday, right here at the Horn. Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yep. And this here is our little ongoing conversation. Thank you very kindly, Thomas, from FYINation.com, noting loud and clear on FYINation.com, thoughts and prayers, hope this thorn doesn't hurt. Ow! Yep. Welcome to the chat room this evening, Jules. Good to see you. And welcome, Snorky. Good evening, Snorky. See, folks, just wandering in. Let's see. This is a listener-supported operation. I'm happy to report, of course, that as you heard, if you heard last night's program, Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge was met with little or no pain whatsoever, and we had some subscribers kick in overnight. Thank you very kindly. So that I can happily note that the fundraising goal for this evening is $150. 15 at 10, 10 at 15, 1 at 150, 2 at 75. You do the rest, okay? But the PayPal button is over at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. If you prefer the U.S. Postal Service, you can always use that method, checks and money orders. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. Let me know when you do that so that I can tell Boss Man Wayne he can leave the spider-proof gloves in the truck and only take the anti-clan axe handle with him when he goes. Yeah. To the UPS store where the mailbox is, where the clan also has a mailbox. You never... it still drives me crazy, but I guess there's nothing we can really do about it. Thank you very kindly. Anatole saying that he'll be kicking in when the check clears. That's one. Thank you very, very kindly, Anatole. Thank you very much. Let's see. It's about 4 minutes past the hour, and I thought... You know, it's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and we use Thorn in the Side Thursday for those moments that just kind of make us collectively go, yo! whether it be right wing, and sometimes it's not right wing. Sometimes it's people on our side, and that happens to be the case this evening. I'm not particularly pleased about it. But it is the case. Sometimes people on our side get things so astonishingly wrong, and usually with the best of intentions, but they get things so astonishingly wrong that they kind of have to be examined and deconstructed a little bit. And that happened for me earlier today when I ran across an article from The Inquisitor by Caitlin Johnstone, and Caitlin Johnstone feels the burn, and I'm not going to give anybody hell for feeling the burn. And to a certain extent, her thesis echoes something that I've said, if anything, we owe electing Bernie Sanders to the future, because neither of the other candidates give a rat's ass about what happens in the future. I'm kind of violating my own sense of trying to stay out of the political swamps as much as possible by dealing with this topic. But it's not about Bernie, it's not about Hillary, it's not about Trump, except ancillarily. And so I have asked, and I hope I thought I'd said, "Oh hi, I'm Bob Kincaid," didn't I? No. Hold on here. Let me get this all sent to dadgummit. But anyway, this is a touching note from Brother Usher Steve up in New York. Steve says, "I really can't give thanks to you and the Horn family enough. It was a very bad time today. I wasn't feeling suicidal. Those days are thankfully past, but I felt close. Hearing the Horn is that important to me to help with my mood." That's touching indeed, Steve. Touching indeed. So here's how it breaks out. This article that I'm referring to by Caitlin Johnstone does echo something that I've been talking about, that the future belongs to the people who are not going to live in it, or the future belongs to the people who are going to live in it, not 68-year-old, power-mad, ambitious, Wall Street-driven, et cetera, or Donald Trump. Obviously, Bernie Sanders is a solid 6 years older than Hillary Clinton. Wow, 6 years. He's really old. See what a bottle of Miss Clairol can do for you? But he at least understands that the future belongs to those who will live in it. And for a while now, I've been having an off-again, on-again conversation with a good friend of mine named Mike Rozelle. Now, Mike has been on this program in the past. Mike is a campaigner extraordinaire. Many of the so-called environmental organizations that you care about, because Mike helped get them started, like Greenpeace, like the Rainforest Action Network, okay? Most recently, one of the things that he did was to start a little something here in West Virginia called Climate Ground Zero, because, you know, West Virginia is the cradle of climate change. But the nature of the conversation that I've been having with Mike, and I want to have with Mike now, with all of us, to sort of comment and think about, is what it means when we talk about transitioning to a sustainable energy future? Because I don't, you know, it's one of those Inigo Montoya moments. You know, that word, I don't think it means what you think it means. And I don't think, and I think Mike doesn't think, it means what most people think it means, if that makes any sense at all. Are you there, Mike?
Yes, I am, Bob.
Well, thank you very kindly. I know you're not in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cole, Virginia, Stan. You're somewhere out in the heartland right now, if I understand correctly. But I thank you very much for joining in this evening.
Yeah, thank you. I'm on the very edges of the Appalachian bioregion in southern Indiana, which is a very beautiful place. I met a friend of mine, sir. Sustainable organic farm here, Andy Mahler, a fellow I think you know.
Oh, yes, Andy's a fine, fine, fine man. Please convey to him my fond regards.
I will.
But you saw the article because I tagged you directly on Facebook and said, you know, this will make you kick furniture. You later responded that it was some of the worst climate writing you had lately seen, and you've seen some bad climate writing.
Well, it's kind of all boilerplate now. That people just throw out the same things that everybody else is saying, and they don't really explain how those things can be so. But there's just so much greenwashing from the green side of this argument right now that it's almost impossible to have a discussion about what's probably really necessary. And, you know, the fact is we don't know. We really don't know how to deal with this problem. This problem is bigger than anything we've ever dealt with. And anyone who tries to make it seem like it's going to be a walk in the park is really delusional or dishonest.
Well, one of the things that sort of leapt out at me out of this opinion piece, and again, you know, I'm in agreement with the general tone of it because I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders. I don't think the United States generally has the first foggy clue as to what we're talking about when we're talking about a clean energy future. Recycling is great. The moving away from fossil fuels and hydrocarbons and it's all necessary. But as you have pointed out to me, and we've talked about it at some length in the past, when we start talking about a world, because there's a statement that this woman makes, and she's a mother. There's a statement she makes in this piece at the Inquisitor where she says, "We can stop using oil now."
That's absurd. You know, much of the focus on solar and wind really has been on household electricity use, and it is true that, you know, some countries have done very well to replace that. But when we talk about automobiles and trains and trucks and the ship that, you know, bring all of our goods from overseas, you can't run those on solar collectors. They can't be powered by wind. So they're just leaving so much off the table there and kind of giving us this rosy scenario that this is actually going to be easy creating new businesses. But nowhere do we hear that we're going to have to sacrifice our opulent lifestyle. You know, it's opulent compared to the rest of the people in the world. We can't expect the rest of the people in the world to get up to our energy consumption and still produce it. So, you know, we're trying to maintain our elite status. Some people don't emit much carbon at all. Those are the really poor agricultural peoples, tribal peoples, you know, the few hunter-gatherers that are left out there. But this big middle class that we're talking about trying to revive, this is something that we simply can't provide to every citizen of the earth. So at some point we've got to say there's either too many of us, or those of us that are here, we're asking for way too much from the earth. So, you know, any way to solve this problem is going to, it's going to need a recognition of that.
Well, inside this article, there's this point where she says, you know, we don't have to have cars. Well, you know, she doesn't live in Rock Creek, West Virginia, or any of the other hills and hollers. I mean, I don't have a wagon and a mule that I can't hitch old Dobbin to the Shay,
right?
And make a 12-mile round trip up to the Wiggling Pig to get my necessaries.
Yeah,
and they're not going to bring the stuff that I buy at the Wiggling Pig. via Stagecoach. And there's no rail spurs around here either.
Well, I mean, we got by a long time without cars, but we've redesigned everything for the car. Some cities, 40% of the landmass is either paved or devoted to automobile maintenance or storage. So it's going to be really hard to reverse that, but I think it's a direction we have to go. But for people who are living in rural areas, poor people, they don't have a choice. They have to have a car. And until we can redesign everything, which I don't think we can do overnight, and I don't even think we know how to do it, that the automobile is going to be with us. Oil, people would starve to death if we stopped using oil right now.
And we wouldn't be able to farm.
We wouldn't be able to, you know, so it's not, you can't just turn off the switch.
Well, you know, Michael Pollan, years back in his his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, made the observation that the American diet is comprised primarily of number two field grade corn and diesel fuel. When you get right down to it, this is, you know, and you know, we've got friends who drive long haul trucks who listen to this program as well, Mike, and they have educated me on a concept called just in time product delivery. So that you know, nobody has any stuff stored back. There, you know, it's this constant repetition of delivery systems, and under a system like that, we are ill prepared to even begin to think about living sustainably, and that's, you know, that's why I particularly wanted to have this conversation with you. Do you have any idea? I mean, can you give people any sense of what that's going to look like?
Well, I mean, let's be brutally honest. We have entered a period of abrupt climate change. I think, you know, when Al Gore talked about the hockey stick, we were in the handle, now we're in the blade. This year, I think, was the year that we can, I think, pretty confidently say that we are now going to see more abrupt warming after the gradual warming that we've had. Now, if we decarbonized 100% tomorrow morning, that this wouldn't change. It would slow it down, and eventually something might happen. But we've got feedback mechanisms. Methane is not even figured into all this stuff when they talk about CO2 and global warming gases that we've got. Boreal forests burning and their soils decomposing. We've got hydrates. I mean, I could go down the list, but, you know, all the alarm bells should be going off. We're in a burning theater, and, you know, it's just not right for people to say, well, enjoy the movie, everything is going to be all right. We need to be taking some kind of drastic actions and doing things we don't even really yet understand how to do, but we at least have to attempt them.
Well, you know, I mean,
we're in a place where we're going to be mitigating climate change, and it's just really a matter of how much time does it take before this catches up with us. You know, a lot of the scientists are saying that, you know, the Earth may be unlivable by 2075, but some of them are saying that it may be unlivable by 2030. And this is if we don't, I mean, this is if we stop all carbon emissions now. So we're really in a spiral. It's all about mitigation and adaptation now. And I think it's just not realistic. It's not really on the horizon that we're going to go to zero fossil fuels anytime in the near future, which is what we would have needed to do in the 70s.
Yeah, back when Carter was telling us we needed to do that. Carter was right.
And, you know, it's the people who are saying, well, Exxon hid all this information from us. We've all known this. Anybody that has a subscription to Scientific American or, you know, does any at all reading of the popular scientific literature knew that this was coming down the pike. The only difference is that it's happening a lot sooner than most of the scientists had predicted earlier, last century. But it was predicted, even though it's happening quicker. It was always predicted. So we're there. We're there. Now what? Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel a little bit silly, but if we can't stop mining coal in Appalachia, if we can't stop fracking, if we can't stop all these big projects, we can't really claim that we're doing anything, right? And we've been beating our head against this wall for quite a while. I know you have longer than I have. But we're in a dire situation. I mean, I don't have any good news on the climate front, and I'm a little bit frustrated with professional climate activists, peddling this rosy scenario that is just really illogical.
Well, I mean,
so
and
we do? I don't know what we do.
I don't either, and maybe it's okay that we don't, except for the fact that I wish some of the people who think they're helping would stop helping. I don't need another article, because I see one or two a week, Mike, from supposed allies who say, "Oh, coal is dead in Appalachia. We've won." It's a big stinking ugly lie.
No, it's a very dangerous lie, and it's something that has frustrated me. And I know you and a lot of us here who have worked to try to end strip mining in Appalachia. And that is exactly their line. I mean, the Rainforest Action Network, one of the organizations that I started, they sent out a photo when they got Citibank to sign on to, they wouldn't loan money to companies that had more than 40% of their assets invested in mountaintop removal or something ridiculous like that, right? So they sent out this picture of these beautiful Appalachian mountains in the fall. There's just ridgeline after ridgeline after ridgeline. You can't see that anywhere else but here. And they had a little arrows to each mountaintop saying, save, save, save. Well, so I wrote the board. I'm emeritus. I'm not an actual member of the board anymore. But I sent an email and I said, can any one of you tell me where these mountains are? And why do you think they're saved? And, I got no response. And I sent him back a response. I said, that's the Smoky Mountains. That's the Smoky Mountains. They were saved 100 years ago, and they don't have any coal.
Don't have any coal under them. Right.
But it was, for them, it was just something they could throw out to their members, assuring them that, they're on the forefront of saving the environment, and that, they're a worthy organization to give money to. And none of that money they raise on mountaintop removal. And this. They hire all these mountaintop removal coordinators. If they spend a couple of nights in Appalachia per year, that would be a lot. We don't get any of those resources. So, we are trying to push the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act through Congress, which I think if we actually could get people talking about it, which is a no-brainer, people would do it. But they're burying us, and they refuse to support the bill. Some of them have actually actively lobbied against it. After Bo Webb and Maria Gano and, a lot of our people who go out to Washington, D.C., talk to these Congress people, well, they come in afterwards, have a meeting afterwards and say, now these people
No, don't do that. Those hillbillies don't know what they're talking about.
Those hillbillies do not know nothing about Washington, about politics. And this has, of course, been going on for 100 years. And, but we pay the price for that, and that's, it's really upsetting that, one of our biggest impediments to moving forward with just a simple bill to say you can't blow up a mountain. I mean, this is not, restructuring the whole economy or asking for any major sacrifices. But, they can't even get behind that because they feel that, no one's ever going to do it.
What I find so interesting out of this discussion, though, is that, we're only living in a world that has been electrified and rapid transitified, for 125 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of the story of humanity on planet Earth does not involve fossil fuels, hydrocarbons, or anything like that.
Right.
How is it that
before World War II, 50% of the people lived in small towns and rural communities and probably could have gotten by without a car, but look how much our population has grown in that.
And look at the deruralization of that self same population.
Right.
Any given large city in the United States, and most people don't think about it, lives on the brink of disaster. 2 weeks top steps before serious hunger begins to set in, a month before starvation sets in.
Yeah. When you get a tornado warning or a hurricane warning, like the shelves are empty in 48 hours. They don't carry inventory anymore, like these truck drivers were telling me. You know, it's on-demand stuff. So we don't have the resilience. And that's something we, you know, in the Bible, it's the 7 years of, plenty and the 7 years of lean. We're not thinking about that. But that's something we should be thinking about now, is that we need to start stocking up. There's going to be some major scarcity. There already is in many parts of the world. This has already happened.
And that's another part of that. When we talk about not doing anything about climate change, there is an overall impact on the entire population of the planet. But it is to a certain extent marginalized in the richest portions of the planet. But the people who can least afford to deal with it and are least protected take it on the chin. Think about the people of the Maldives Islands, for instance. But not just the Maldives, all over the world. You know, look at the people of the Niger Delta who have been summarily, in many senses, summarily executed for oil exploration. Well, those are the people who take it on the chin because we do nothing about climate change. But when I read an article like the one that got us going here, Mike, I have this really unsettling suspicion that they're also the people who will take it on the chin from the folks who sit in their privileged perches and talk about what others must do to help allay climate change. You know, we want India to, calm down, and China's got to do something. And you hear this from the billionaire class and the industrial class in the United States and Western Europe all the time. Well, why should we have to do everything? I mean, the Chinese are over there, and what about the Indians? Well, they didn't cause the problem, now did they? But we're going to ask the poorest people in the world to take it on the chin for climate change, just like the wealthy people are asking the poorest people in the world to take it on the chin for not doing anything about climate change. There seems to be some wealthism and some racism and some classism worked in on both sides of the equation, isn't there? Oh, dear, I fear I have... wait a minute. I lost Mike somehow or another. Hopefully we'll get him back. I hope it wasn't a cordless phone that the handset died.
Hi, this is Andy.
Oh, hey, Andy. This is Bob Kincaid. I was just talking to Mike.
Hey, Bob.
We were on the air. I was talking with Mike, and then boom, Mike was gone.
Okay, let me get Mike back for you. Just one sec.
Okay, thanks. They're great folks out there in southern Indiana, by the way.
Roselle, Kincaid.
See how it works?
My phone died?
No. Hello.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, the battery on the phone went out.
I'm like a prophet. I said, I hope his phone battery hasn't died. But when the phone died, what I was saying is that it seems like both sides of this debate are asking the poorest people in the world to take it on the chin for whatever kind of plan they have.
Well, they're ignoring them. Basically, everybody's kind of just thinking about themselves. They can get an electric car or whatever. But yeah, we've abandoned the poor people around the world. There needs to be a Marshall Plan right now, some major commitment of not just some resources, but all the resources that we have. Let's put it all on the table. This is the real deal here. And try to figure out how to keep these people from perishing. It's not about even surviving. There's 60 million refugees right now. A lot of those are climate related because of drought, water shortages, food shortages. And this is just the tip of that iceberg. So there's not a lot of concern when you hear those, you know, like we were talking about this article. Where is the concern there for all the poor people of the world who would be fine without us? But
because they'd be living the lives that they've been, that their forebears have been living for the last, you know, 100,000 years.
Yes. Yes, I mean, we went a long time without emitting much carbon, and then all of a sudden it just really spiked, you know, during the beginning of the last century. Well, starting with the Industrial Revolution, but even that was kind of tiny compared to what we're doing now. And, you know, and per capita American energy consumption is still going up, and the population is still going up. And just, you know, none of the arrows are pointing in the right direction right now, unless you can consider the little bit of alternatives that we're developing are cutting some of the, you know, they're cutting into some of the growth. But overall, it's still growing. It hasn't eliminated the growth of fossil fuel use. It's still rising. It's projected to rise until 2030 under some of the more conservative financial projections. But, you know, some of the people are saying it can happen sooner, but I don't see any evidence. There's no laws being passed. There's no restrictions. You know, and during World War II, we had gasoline rationing, not because we didn't have enough gasoline, but because we didn't have enough rubber for tires, and they needed the rubber for the war effort. It was, you know, the Japanese had controlled many of the rubber plantations. So we're not even doing anything. You know, this is worse than World War II. And we're not taking any of those kind of measures that we took then. You know, there were big recycling programs and victory gardens and stuff, and we're not doing that. No one's doing that. So for these people to say, like, oh, we're moving in the right direction, we haven't moved off of it at all. We're still heading in the wrong direction.
Well, so you just touched on something that I was thinking about earlier, to wit, victory gardens, you know, scrap metal drives, the rationing of gas, that kind of thing during the Second World War. And then, you know, we had a war on poverty, and we've had a war on drugs, and a war. Is that what the American people have to have? I mean, do we have to call it a war on something to get the American people's attention? And if that's the case, why didn't we declare a war on climate change 30, 40 years ago?
Well, you know, I just think it's a matter of history that wars mobilize societies in a way that nothing else does. And, you know, a lot of times people go through these terrible experiences in the war and they survive, and years later they'll think back, wow, those were good times, you know, when we were all together and we were fighting for our own lives, but we had these moments of closeness to each other. And so, but we don't have anything resembling that. I mean, not even a moon launch kind of effort, which was, you know, a considerable amount of the U.S. You know, economy was put into the space program.
Well, I mean, we've seen a city drown. We've seen the Gulf poisoned. We've seen tornadoes rip through the very heart of Christian, pious, worshiping America. Is there anything that gets the attention of the American people?
Well, this was, you know, one of the things that I've come to realize, because back in the 70s or 80s or even into the 90s, I was thinking, well, none of this organizing, none of this politicking that's going on around climate change is likely to accomplish much, but things will be shaped by events. And when Katrina hit, I actually thought that was an event that would trigger, you know, some kind of a major response. Just like I thought when Charleston's water was poisoned, you know, that this would trigger a response in Charleston to, you know, to take on the coal and chemical industry. But unfortunately, these events, as terrible as they are not getting that kind of a response. And I think people are getting somewhat numb to them, and I think they're just sitting there waiting until, you know, like they're on the Queen Mary, and they're just waiting until the water comes into their cabin. They're not going to worry about it until.
Well, I mean, mentioning Katrina, so if something like a Katrina happened, only the people really do it, only we had lots of images of white people suffering, would that do it?
No, I really don't. I mean, we had Sandy, you know, the Hurricane Sandy, who went into a white neighborhood in New York and flooded it. And I don't really see New York out there on the forefront of, you know, trying to prepare their city for climate change. So, no, I mean, I don't think that's enough. I don't. People are going to get numb to it. I mean, I wish I had some good news, Bob.
No. I understand. I'm just trying to sort of thought experiment my way through it, because whatever's coming is coming.
Right.
And it's
no,
not.
I think they could get Manhattan and take out everything right now, and people would just go, "Oh well, you know, their attention span is about 2 weeks for tragedies like that." But you know, maybe there needs to be some kind. I mean, it's going to take. There's 8 billion people on this planet. It's going to take all 8 billion of us working together on it at this point. And right now, there's just a very small percentage of us that are actually working on it, and the rest of the people are just either biting their nails or biding their time.
I mean, there are some people out there who go off the grid. They go out in the country. They get a couple of acres. They put in a garden every year. They've got solar panels. They make choices between, you know, running the fan and running the computer, or running the computer and running the lights. And those are the kind of the choices that are out in the future. But
yeah, I mean, certainly they've demonstrated that it's possible to live off the grid. You know, but not everybody can do that. And but also, you know, a lot of those folks, by neglecting to make the necessary political changes, you know, just, you know, what happens when the temperature goes up to 110 degrees? You can't grow corn anymore. What happens when your forests burn down? And we're just seeing we're starting to see the ecosystem collapse. You know, we're in the sixth great extinction. That's even separate from climate change, which is interesting that they just happen to be coming at the same time, but what they're not unrelated. But, you know, the geologists have basically said that we're in a new epoch, the Anthropocene. It will be a major extinction event, and if you came back 100 million years from now, you would see a drastic reduction in the, you know, biological diversity, the number of species, and it would be visible to any geologist or rock hound. We're in that, and you know, the fifth great extinction, nothing made it out that weighed over 40 pounds. No mammal weighing over 40 pounds made it. We're not likely to be survivors of this extinction. It's just a matter of when it unrolls. How do we deal with this? I don't know. But, you know, I've come to accept it. I mean, I was looking down the barrel of this gun, you know, even during the 70s when we were reading The Ecologist and the first Earth Day. I mean, these are not new issues. We've been talking about this. They were talked about in the 19th century as well. But, you know, now that they're here upon us, we're not talking about the future anymore, we're talking about the present. And that's what I think, you know, a lot of the climate politics misses. You know, they're still acting like we can avoid this terrible future. We're in that future now, and how do we deal with it? I don't know anyone who knows the answer to that question. But certainly preserving your forest, preserving your farmland, preserving biological diversity is going to be necessary no matter what.
So without
those frontline campaigns, where, you know, at least we're doing some good.
There are those of us who are basically standing around with, you know, we're characters out of a Hans Christian Andersen fable, and we've got our thumb, you know, trying to hold back an entire ocean's worth of water from a hole in the dike. But I almost feel dirty drawing politics into this. But in the midst of this, I can't help but think about a clip that I've seen repeatedly of Hillary Clinton saying, "We're either going to get dirty oil from the Middle East, or we're going to get dirty oil from Canada." That's what she said when the first time that she greenlighted the Keystone XL pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that was the no impact on the climate was what the environmental assessment was, because she's kind of right, except for the Saudi oil is much cleaner than the tar sand stuff is just awful.
Yeah.
We'd be better off just saying, let's let Saudi Arabia and Iran be our gas station for now, all this unconventional stuff we shut down. They have enough if we husband it well. We don't have to drill another single well. And hopefully we don't even have to use that entire reserve, which no one really knows how big it is. But it's always proven to be bigger than anybody thought it was. But just like Edward Goldsmith predicted back in the 70s, we were never going to run out of oil. We were going to run out of the ability of the Earth to absorb all of the gases from burning this oil. No one believed him because, people were talking about peak oil. Oil is everywhere. Oil is everywhere. And now they know how to get it in places where we couldn't get it before. But it would be better just to use the infrastructure that's already there. And, we've got to power down. I mean, that's just something that needs to be done. And we don't know how much benefit we will get from it, but we certainly know how much tragedy we'll get if we don't do it. And that's what we should be doing, and we're not doing it. And there's still talks about going in the Arctic, and they're still opening up new oil fields, and they're fracking places you couldn't believe, state parks, national parks, wherever they can do it. That we're still heading, willy-nilly, helter-skelter in the exact wrong direction of where we should be going. And, all this talk about how, where the revolution has begun, we have a climate movement. I mean, it doesn't appear to be a movement to me. We have a movement against mountaintop removal. We have a movement against deforestation. But the climate campaign, I wouldn't describe it as a movement. It doesn't have a clear vision for the future. People are not truly united behind it. It's a very vague thing. And it means different things to everybody. Some people it means we're going to have to build more nuclear reactors, and some people think it's all about electric cars. And those really aren't going to help us that much.
Well, it is a daunting problem to consider, Mike. And it's also a depressing one. I mean, when you mentioned Charleston, West Virginia a little bit ago, when 300,000 people get poisoned, and not even 1% of the poisoned will show up to demand demand accountability of the government. At least you had an outcry in Flint, Michigan, but by the same token, to what end? I mean, that's a matter of replacing plumbing. And it's not going to happen. Now we find out that little children going to school in Portland, Oregon, have been drinking bottled water for the remainder of the term because of the elevated levels of lead in Portland, Oregon's water.
Yes. One of our more liberal cities, one of our more green-thinking cities.
Probably the most green-thinking city in the United States,
West
right?
West Virginia.
And that's funny. Judy Bond said if we don't stop mountaintop removal in West Virginia, it's going to spread like the cancer it is.
Yeah.
And I don't think she knew quite how prophetic she was at the time. Because some element of what it means to be Appalachia is finally being felt in other parts of the country.
Yes.
Because you learn what it means to be absolutely expendable.
Well, look at the folks who lived in the gated community down there in L.A. where they had the big gas blowout. They had all money and power and fences to keep out outsiders, and yet they were breathing all that toxic gas for months, without even being told at first. They weren't even told. So, they're all being treated like Appalachians now. See how they like it. They probably don't like it. We don't like it either.
Yeah, we're all hillbillies now, my friend.
We are all hillbillies now.
Well, Mike, I really appreciate the time that you've afforded us. I hope you have an enjoyable and hopefully restful time out there in southern Indiana.
I got to cook for 30 permaculture students, forging a new agriculture. It'll be fun.
Hey, that's part of it, Mike. A new permaculture. I tell people, because I think back to my ancestors here in Appalachia, my ancestors were sustainable before sustainable was cool.
Oh, yeah, and they didn't really have a choice. But, the soil is, that's where all the solar energy hits, and it knows how to take care of it. It turns it into carbon. Grasslands, farmlands, all these things could be absorbing carbon instead of emitting them if we just were using them with more care and you know, agriculture is a big part of the carbon problem right now, and it could easily be solved, and it also could create a whole lot more jobs for people, which would be a little bit more meaningful. I know people didn't want to work on the farms for a long time; they were lured by the mines and the factories. But we've got to get rid of that mindset, and you know, try to get back to the farms and out of the factories.
Well, that's the absolute truth, and somewhere along the way, you know, maybe there's a hybrid civilization in the Borning, you know, a farm with enough land to feed a family, of a family with a very carefully managed size, you know, and you know, Jesus, farms in Kansas had wind turbines 150 years ago, right?
Yes.
For drawing water up out of the aquifer. You know, it's not, and you know, in my own mother's childhood, the electricity that they had in their home was from Delco batteries that they would periodically take and trade in for a recharged one, just like we take
just
a propane
the one
tank
on your truck.
Well, there we go. Yeah. So
yeah. So there's ways to do this. We can certainly live without emitting a fraction of the carbon that we do now. And people have demonstrated this. There's been plenty of people who've proven this, but we're not doing it. And the problem is the environmental movement is not telling us that this is necessary. They act like that we can simply replace this vast amount of energy that we use with a new source, rather than say, well, how about just using what our great-grandparents used? You know, that kind of a budget. But you know, that doesn't poll well. The consultants don't like it. The focus groups don't react well to it. And so, you know, we used to have David Brower, who was a great teller of the truth, you know, and he would always tell us that we were heading for extinction. You know, he never sugarcoated the, he was the founder of Friends of the Earth and the Great Sierra Club executive director, but for those of you who don't know, but yeah, he was one of my mentors, but he never soft-pedaled this. You know, he always made it clear to all of us on his staff that, you know, the planet is dying, you know, and we're just a small group of people, and we can't really win any campaign. We can only delay the death sentence. And so I've been living with this heavy thoughts for quite a while.
Well, no doubt. And let me ask you one question before you go and before you get back to the kitchen. We affect the change that we can affect. Neither you nor I are going to change any Republican minds, okay,
right,
or any conservative or capitalist minds. But what will it take, or what would it take, or do you know, or do you have a theory, how to get these big green organizations that seem to be getting it so wrong to maybe even open their ears to trying to, and their eyes to trying to get it right?
They have no interest. These people live very high on the hog. You know, it's not like it used to be. You know, I remember when Friends of the Earth was mostly volunteers who barely had any money. Greenpeace was the same way at that time. Now these people are paid, you know, almost equal to if they were in corporate America. And they don't know how to live on incomes lower than that. And so sustaining those institutions that sustain them is more important than any issue. They don't take a very long view. So I have actually given up on them. I think something, and I think it is happening. I'm starting to see clergy getting involved. I'm starting to see mayors get really upset and start saying the right thing. I'm starting to hear army generals do it. You know, these people have a lot more pull than the NGOs that call themselves the climate movement. So they need to grow quickly. They need to coalesce around some kind of a plan of action, and they will make these groups irrelevant. And I think that's the only hope that we have. As long as these institutions that we, you know, they were more effective in the 70s and 80s than they were now. Times have changed. These groups have not changed. And they're still using strategies that we developed in the 80s and 90s that were really geared to educate the public. Well, the public doesn't need more education anymore. You know, what they really need is to be mobilized around some kind of plan of action, and people are trying to do that, but no one really believes that anything they can do is going to make a difference right now, and so everybody's holding back. So if some group, if some movement, if some person, I mean, Bernie Sanders has been great on climate. I mean, the speeches I've seen him make, I wish we'd have been hearing those speeches 20, 30 years ago by presidential candidates. We may not be in this problem. And I think he's been right on. I don't have a lot of criticisms of anything he said. It would just be the things that maybe he didn't say.
Well, I think...
I think it's a good development, but you know, and maybe he's unleashed something there just by using that bully puppet and getting all these new people involved in the process who will use their own brains to figure stuff out. No one person, no one group can come up with a solution here. It's going to take a lot of different people doing a lot of different
things.
Well, you
know, I think even though he was a notorious racist, I think of Winston Churchill telling the British people, all I can offer you is blood, toil, tears, and sweat.
Yes, we need that.
And they loved him for that.
And if
there's anything that Bernie hasn't said, and probably, you know, it's not the kind of thing you can say on the campaign trail.
Sure, sure.
But we've got to have that, for lack of a better term, come to Jesus moment where we say, you know, this is going to be hard, but if there's anybody who can do it, we can.
No, I mean, that used to be how we thought of ourselves as a country that would suffer and sacrifice for our values. Not one who would just sit back and, you know, eat chips and watch TV. That was the whole myth of America, that we were willing to fight. We were willing to die. We were willing to starve. We were willing to work hard. And, you know, if we can get that kind of spirit into this, there's a certain camaraderie. There's a certain unity that comes out of that that is more important than money. It's more important even than food. And, you know, that's why when people look back on these terrible experiences they had in World War II, they thought, wow, we were so close to each other. We, you know, we had something there that we lack today, even though we have food on the table and we're not getting shot at by Nazis. And it's going to be a thing about, you know, I'm not a spiritual person, but it does require a spirit, an esprit de corps, you know, some kind of camaraderie where we're doing this for and with each other and there's more trust. And movements have sprung up in the past, and we need one now. I've been trying my life to try to figure out how, you know, to lay any kind of groundwork to make that possible. And, you know, it has not yet happened, but that doesn't mean it won't happen.
And all we can do is keep pushing. Mike Rozelle, thank you very kindly.
It's
always a joy talking to you, and I hope we get to hang out sometime soon.
All right. I hope I didn't bum your listeners out too much. But, yeah, we'll get together soon.
Well, thanks, if anybody can talk reality, we can do it here. Thanks, Mike Rozelle.
All right.
Bye now. My buddy Mike Rozelle, and, you know, a little dose of reality spoken here. Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, your calls and maybe a little bit more, delve into that article a little bit. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back.
Dave Matthews Band, Don't Drink the Water, seemed appropriate at the time. I think it still is. 2 minutes before the hour for this Thorn in the Side Thursday, and I think you understand now why I wanted to have that conversation with Mike Rozelle. He has been gnawing this bone for a lot more years than I can even think about. And he hasn't come to any great epiphanies either. Except to say that it's a frightening future we're looking at, and you know, when you look into the eyes of, say, a 9-year-old, it becomes particularly daunting. If you want to see the article that sort of got me on my high horse, go to Inquisitor.com. Inquisitor.com, Inquisitor, or Inquisitor.com. The author is Caitlin Johnstone, and she says things like, "We can stop using oil now," which I'm not sure exactly how we do that, but. Going to be a lot of misery involved. She writes, "This is a hard piece to write. The planet is stressed to the max. In Chile, tons of dead fish have been washing up on the shore. We have garbage patches in the Pacific the size of countries. A third of the Great Barrier Reef is dead. People are buying cans of fresh air in China. We've all seen the signs. You've hurriedly scrolled past as many of these stories as I have, with your heart leaping in your throat, hoping it's not true. We need a total 180-degree turnaround in the opposite direction, and we need it yesterday.
But it's easy to type that. It is not nearly easy as easy to conceptualize that. Oh no. To really come to a gut level understanding of what it means to be a human being in that world. And given that we live on an overpopulated planet, start asking questions like, okay, who dies? Or are we just going to let climate change take care of some of it, and the ones who are left over, well, you know, they'll live however they have to. And this is all in the form of a pro-Bernie piece, and I can't take issue with that. But the she says there is, and we talked about it here on the program. There's this viral video going around this week of a small child crying in frustration about how we adults are destroying the planet. We were all that child once, and our mothers were all just as clueless as to how to explain why we do the mad things we do. And she embeds a picture of the little fella. We talked about him, Harry. And KATU News said, little environmentalist gets emotional talking about Earth's future. You know, what a slur to call him a little environmentalist. He's a little human being upon whom it has dawned what's being done, not to Earth's future, but to his. And she goes after Trump, and that's cool. And she goes after Hillary, and that's cool. And what she says is truthful. When I find myself, when I find myself asking questions like this, I find it often handy to go back to another of the prophets. This one being Joe Bagent, who would probably rebel at the idea of being called a prophet. But the last, before he died, the last column he ever published, Tuesday, the 7th of December, 2010, America, why your peeps be so dumb? Ignorance and courage in the age of Lady Gaga. And he wrote, if you hang out much with thinking people, conversation eventually turns to the serious political and cultural questions of our times, such as, how can the Americans remain so consistently brainfucked? Much of the world, including plenty of Americans, asks that question as they watch U.S. culture go down like a thrashing mastodon giving itself up to some Pleistocene tar pit. One explanation might be the effect of 40 years of deep-fried industrial chicken pulp and 44-ounce big gulp soft drinks. Another might be pop culture, which is not culture at all, of course, but marketing. Or we could blame it on digital autism. Ever watch commuter monkeys on the subway poking at digital devices, stroking the touch screen for hours on end? Those wrinkled Neolithic brows above the squinting red eyes? But a more reasonable explanation is that A, we don't even know we're doing it, and B, we cling to institutions dedicated to making sure we never find out. As William Edwards Deming famously demonstrated, no system can understand itself and why it does what it does, including the American social system. Not knowing shit about why your society does what it does makes for a pretty nasty case of existential unease. So we create institutions whose function is to pretend to know, which makes everyone feel better. Unfortunately, it also makes the savviest among us, those elites who run the institutions, very rich or safe from the vicissitudes that buffet the rest of us. Directly or indirectly, they understand the real function of American social institutions is to justify, rationalize, and hide the true purpose of cultural behavior from the lumpen proletariat and to shape that behavior to the benefit of the institution's members. Hey, they're a lump. What do you expect us to do? And it goes on in that vein, and I highly recommend it. Just go to Joe Bagent, BAGEANT.net. It's hard for me to imagine that he's been gone 5.5 years. But by God, he remains as relevant as the day he typed this stuff. And I suspect will for the foreseeable future. But I can't help wondering, where are the thought leaders on this stuff? I mean, we have them. We have some fine public intellectuals on the progressive side, and they do some great public intellectualizing. But we need it down on the, dare I say, on the micro level. We need to talk about what communities that don't have that aren't tied to a centralized electric grid look like, how they behave, how they function. We also need to talk about how an industrial culture functions in an age when the mere burning of a hydrocarbon to produce energy means disaster for countless God knows how many untold millions, if not billions, of human beings. How do you maintain industry under those circumstances? Do you ration? Do you say we're only going to burn hydrocarbons to do this but not that? We'll burn coal to make steel but not to make electricity? How do you do that? And there's just, I mean, I've looked around, but there's just not a ton of that out there. Let's run over to the Skype line. You know, both lines are open. The stress line, of course, is area code 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676. And the Skype line is Bob Kincaid Horn, and the other line is 304-574-8178. Let us go forthwith to the Skype line and Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott.
Greetings and salutations.
And hallucinations, Bob, unto you and Punky.
Right on, right on, right on. Punky is fine. I, however, have been under the weather.
You don't sound like your usual chipper self.
For the last couple of days. I've been sicker than three dogs.
At night?
And morning, noon, and night. But, I must preface this. I enjoyed your guest, but I must preface this. I don't want to come across like Debbie Downer, okay? But the train quite possibly has left the station. we used to have a saying back in the 60s, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And it seems to me in the late 70s, didn't Jimmy Carter give a speech which came to be known as the malaise
speech? Yes.
Yeah, even though he never used that word, okay? But he basically told it as it was. He even tried to lead by example by putting solar panels on the White House roof, which Reagan promptly took down after he got elected. He was preaching not to the choir, but to the people who needed to hear it. The problem with people who need to hear it is a lot of them don't want to hear it. And the main problem, as far as stuff not getting handled, has to do with money. There's too goddamn much money tied up in the status quo, in the way things currently are. And it's a risky thing to propose a notion that flies in the face, not to mention the pocketbook, of the people who have got untold billions of dollars tied up in their way of doing things. So, I mean, on the one hand, I think the train has left that station long ago. On the other hand, I think back to Tom Lehrer, who I quote from time to time. He had a song back in the mid-60s called Pollution. And one of the lines from it were, just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Okay?
Yeah.
But we got a grip on that situation before it killed us all. I mean, you look back at the way things were 51 years ago when he performed that song versus the way things are now. But the people who had the money tied up in the structure had to be dragged kicking and screaming to do the right thing. I give you seat belts. I give you air pollution controls on automobiles. I give you water purification. And I mean, I'm of a generation that actually remembers when sewage was dumped in most waterways in this country. So, yeah, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There may be a way out of this, but you and your guest were both right. It's going to require a pretty damn radical shift in consciousness by not only the people who are being affected by it, which is all 7.5 billion of us, but also the people who have money, untold billions of dollars tied up in the status quo. So I don't know whether it's an upper or a downer, but that's my take on it.
Well, it sounds fairly realistic to me, Scott. And the thing is, everything you mentioned, you know, not putting sewage in rivers, having clean drinking water, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, those were all, those were not ends in and of themselves. Those were all, you know, just like Medicare was conceived as starting at 65 and then had Johnson had his way and not himself with Vietnam, for all we know, it would be universal single-payer health care by now. Because it wasn't always meant to stay at 65. Social Security didn't start the way Social Security is as we know it now. These are all starting places that anticipate or that imagine that we will take that and go from there and make things better. They're not attempts at stasis, but that is how they've been treated. And that's, you know, that's where we get into trouble. Because they become, is there a Republican out there that doesn't spit on the ground at the mention of the Clean Water Act? Is there a conservative out there that doesn't curse the unforgiving heavens at the mention of the Clean Air Act?
Any type of regulation, there, what it is, Bob, they know the truth, but they won't admit it to themselves. They're, the mindset of most conservative and obstructionist people is that of your average two-year-old. I don't want to, and you can't make me.
I suppose there's a kernel of truth in that, but it's not that. It's not even that. It's not, I don't want to, and you can't make me. It's, I'm going to do everything. I don't want to. You can't make me, and I'm going to throw a tantrum, and maybe burn the house down. You know, rather than envisioning them as spoiled children, we might be better off envisioning them as dangerous psychopaths.
Well, yeah, I get that. I'm just saying that most of the people who vote for these bastards they've consumed enough Kool-Aid to float your average ocean liner, if they're still making ocean liners. And their mindset is, I don't want to, and you can't make me, only because for the last 30, 35 years, that crap has been pumped into their otherwise empty noggins on right-wing talk radio and right-wing media, what with Fox so-called news more recent days. And nature abhors a vacuum. If there's empty space, something will try to fill it. And I thank my Anglo-Saxon upright Protestant God every morning, noon, and night that I was not born Roger Ailes. That son of a bitch. I read a couple of years ago The Loudest Voice in the Room, the biography of Roger Ailes, unauthorized biography. And that son of a bitch had it in for the little people as far back as you can remember.
Well, the, I'm flummoxed. I mean, I really am. This whole issue drives me a little bit around the bend, because nature abhors a vacuum, and capitalism abhors one even more. And so, where you say if there's where there's an absence, that something will move in. Well, in a capitalist society, what will move in is a way to make a dollar, regardless of the outcome. And that does not bode well for solving any of the problems we talk about needing to solve. Does that terrify the living bejesus out of you?
Yeah, and not only that, but it makes sense. But this is where I'm thinking that it dawned on me not too terribly long ago that by the time the tipping point is reached in the terms of people's consciousness and awareness and willingness to save their own ass, by the time that tipping point hits, it may very well be too late. I mean, there's people today talking about the global climate situation. If it goes up another degree, we're all screwed.
And but I don't want people to get the notion that all of a sudden everybody's just going to expire. That's not how this is going to work. That's not how extinction events generally work.
Oh no, it's a lot more prolonged, and it's a lot less pretty and succinct.
And so consequently, I don't know. In a way, I'm more inclined to look at the way that bubonic plague moved across Asia and Europe. You know, knocking off between 30% and 60% of the population, and there's just enough people left over to try to pick up the pieces. But in a way, it was easier after the Black Death than what will come soon for us, because they at least still had a viable planet. Us, not so much. I used to joke a lot, Scott, and I still do, and probably will continue to joke about what the race of 6-foot-tall sentient cockroaches will think of us in 10 million years. And, I think they'll think we were gods because we made a place filthy enough for them to live in. And they'll probably still be eating our garbage 10 million years from now. And while Mike was talking about, a massive extinction event, one of the species that lasts is going to be the cockroaches. So that means they've kind of got an evolutionary leg up on, they got 6 legs up, don't they? But I'm troubled by this because I don't see a way out. And instead of this being Thorn in the Side Thursday, maybe it's just Thorazine Bob Thursday. Because this is potentially terrifying. And as much as I respect the good intentions of someone like this woman who wrote this article, saying, "Yeah, we can stop burning oil now." No, we can't. Any more than a junkie can stop using heroin now. It takes determination to quit any Jones.
That's the crux of the problem, Bob. And that's what I was sort of getting at, referring back to Jimmy Carter's so-called malaise speech in 79 or 77, 78, somewhere in there. That was the time to really get serious about doing something, in my estimation. And if we had started then and truly made it as important as landing some clown on the moon to pick up a couple of pounds of rocks and dirt, we might be in much better shape today than we are now. This is why I'm saying I'm of two minds, whether it's too late or not too late.
And there's no way to find out but to live it. But if we keep living it like we're living it now, the likelihood that 2 minds scenario persists, Scott, becomes lower and lower and lower.
Yeah, yeah. And see, life is not a dress rehearsal. You, in my estimation, you go around once, and unless you come back as some other form of life in terms of reincarnation, which maybe you do, I don't know. I could go on for an hour and a half about that, but life is not a dress rehearsal. This is it. And unless we begin behaving in a manner consistent with being realistic with ourselves and everybody else and one another, there may not be hope. But I think that human beings do have a capacity to get their noses out of their navels and their heads out of their ass. And I think it was Tom Hartman a couple of years ago read a statistic having to do with if a certain percentage of a given population gets it, okay, that's enough of a mind shift change and consciousness change to affect a different outcome than that which we would otherwise have. And I forget the percentage. It was pretty low. It was like 15 or 20%, as I recall. Maybe somebody knows.
Now, that sounds about right.
But see, it's getting the, like you say, the capitalism problem is a big cog in this machine. And the money factor is a huge, money and power are two of the biggest motivators that we've ever known. People will do all manner of shit for money and power. And, you know, a lot of people, I mean, hitting that 15 or 20% for the shift to occur or to begin to occur, the other folks you're going to have to drag kicking and screaming. Because just as we saw with seatbelts and air pollution devices on automobiles and clean water and clean air and every other beneficial thing that government has ever done over the decades, they've poo-pooed it, they've naysayed it, they've ridiculed it, I have a friend to this very day who calls Franklin D. Roosevelt the commie on the dime.
Dear God. And what can you do about somebody like that?
Well, if I was a religious person, I'd pray for them. But since I'm not, I'm afraid I'll just have to shoot them. Which would be a tragic waste of human life, but it would solve at least that minuscule
fraction. Well, I might argue that it'd be a tragic waste of a bullet.
Well, it might be.
But it kind of goes back to this running thesis that has developed in the last week or so of you know, what do you do about the assholes? I mean, there's a subset of people out there who are so infuriated, so wrought over the idea that climate change, that people think climate change is real, that they deliberately go out and buy diesel vehicles and modify them to create more pollution.
That sounds like my younger brother. I am surprised that we came from the same genetic pool, he and I. Everything that he knows, he learns from Mark Levin on the radio.
Well, I think learning is kind of a loose word to be throwing around, don't you, Scott?
Yeah, it's rather charitable, yeah. But what I'm saying is that'll give you a sense of his mindset. And he was in law enforcement for like 25 years, and he has swilled the Kool-Aid till he can hardly swill any more of it. And we were having a conversation about something. I think it was that thing that I called in about once, about Social Security for disabled people is supposed to be cut by 20% later this year, like September, October, something like that. And it was the first thing that the new Republican House in 2015 did, their first order of business, before they even had the opening prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance and whatever else they do. And it had to do with, there are two pots of money, let's say it's that. And one of the pots of money goes for people on straight line Social Security. The other pot of money goes to people who are disabled. There's like 11 or 12 million of us. And for time immemorial, ever since disabled people were covered by Social Security, if one of the pots is a little low on money, they'll move money from the other pot into that pot and vice versa. And both Democratic and Republican Congresses, both Democratic and Republican presidents have all supported this as a proper way to do business, okay, when it comes to the people's business. And by people's business, I mean the most vulnerable people that there are in our society, okay? So my brother and I were having this conversation on the phone about a year ago when all this came up, and he was maintaining, I forget exactly what, but it was some ludicrous thing about Social Security. And I said, well, George, which is his name, I said, George, I can give you a clip from C-SPAN that would actually prove the validity and the reality of what I'm telling you. And he still wouldn't buy it. Because in his reckoning, they're all corrupt assholes, and most of them are not conservative enough.
And I want to make sure that in the course of my lamentations, that I don't do the same thing that I accuse the Republicans of. In talking with Roselle, you know, we both agreed we don't necessarily know what the answers are, but that there are answers, even if they're hard and depressing ones. Sometimes you deal with the hand that's dealt you. But what you just described is typical of Republicans when we're talking about guns or the environment or the ability of people to live on planet Earth. They tend to say, well, because we can't do everything, there's no sense in doing anything. And that's a recipe for disaster. We can't stop all the killings, so we're not going to close that gun show loophole because, you know, somebody's always going to go crazy with a gun.
Well, it's even worse than that. The, on the gun issue, and Lord knows he's got plenty of guns, these constitutional purists, these Antonin Scalia types, will swear up and down that stuff that a Congress votes in is not under the guidelines of the Constitution, even though the people were duly elected, okay, in the Congress. The president who signed the law was duly elected by the terms of our Constitution. There, you know, it's that old thing, I guess you can't argue with a closed mind, and maybe you can't. But getting back to the tipping point, there ought to be enough people on the planet who have more than a handful of brain cells to bang together who get what I'm talking about and are willing to behave in a manner consistent with bringing about change and seizing upon possibilities while there's time.
While there's time.
Yeah, that's the key.
But the
point,
thing is, we may have run out of time 40 years ago, right?
Yeah, I have a friend who said that after the population hit about 4 billion, the world's population, that at that point, I forget what year it was, in the 70s at some point, I think, the Earth exceeded its carrying capacity. Now, I don't know.
And it's being artificially maintained. Yeah, and we have things that we can look back on in human history. Starting in the generally speaking, in the late 19th century and up into the 20th, and it's still happening, by the way. Lost cities are being found, were found, have been found in Central America and South America. And there's something, I think there's something that particularly bedevils the modern mind to see something like that. The idea that one day everybody just walked away from Palenque or Copan or Chichen Itza or any of those so-called lost cities, but they do that as a survival mechanism. You know, in the case of what we understand of Mayan cities, to the best of my knowledge, based on my reading, you know, it's not like everybody died. It's that a conscious decision was made after they had wrecked their locale, trying to support an unsupportable number of people, including a wealth and priestly and royal class who did absolutely nothing to contribute to the well-being except, you know, interpret the message from the gods. That it got to where the city could no longer, and people went back to life ways that they knew previously, and the descendants of those people are still alive to this day, to the extent that they weren't slaughtered by the Spanish or haven't been slaughtered by their own governments, like say Honduras, you know, the coup there that Hillary Clinton supported as Secretary of State, and the hell on earth that's been unleashed against indigenous people there. But we have that model to look back on. The only thing is, as big as those cities were, and they were big for their time, Scott, they ain't nothing compared to the mega cities of China. Once upon a time, Tenochtitlan was the most populous city on earth. And it's only taken 500 years for it to very nearly have regained that status. Only this time through, it isn't nearly as sustainable or survivable as it was the first time. And so, you know, the idea of these vast towers reaching toward space. I mean, if I was a believing man, I'd run back to Genesis and read all about what was his name, Nabob who built the Tower of Babel and was punished by the Almighty. You know, could that in its own right be a remembering, a cultural remembering of a city that grew beyond its ability to sustain itself? Because we've got plenty of other examples of that. You know, the aliens didn't come down and wipe out the Maya with their chemtrail machines, but they had to leave behind an unsustainable life way.
Well, and see, that's a very telling example. And another aspect of the conversation, you've got these so-called religious types who are basically about manipulation and control, whose sole purpose is to enrich themselves by scaring the shit out of the people. That some angry old man in the sky is going to get them if they don't do like they say. So that's one aspect. Another aspect, and it goes back again to money. Some years ago, I read a statistic, and I don't know how true it was then or even how true it is now. It's been probably 25 years or so. But supposedly, at the time I read it, there are more renewable resources on the planet that if they were converted into something monetary, you could make the every man, woman, and child on the planet the equivalent of a millionaire.
That may very well be true, but the larger truth also looms over us, and that is that I remember one statistic, and it's quite stunning that there's more sunlight hitting a 10 square mile area of Nevada every day than it would take to power the entire nation as it currently uses electricity. Well, that's great, but that still does not confront the storage problems. There's scientific problems here that need to be solved on the level of an Apollo program. But it doesn't confront, as Roselle pointed out, the industrial usages, and it doesn't confront the consumption of rare resources on the planet. And just about everywhere that attempt is underway, there's some mining company that says, "Well, we always try to do this environmentally responsibly," and inevitably there's some poor person who lives next to the pit going, "No, they're not. My neighbors are dying." "Well, you needed to die because we've got to have this because we've got to put it in more phones." I mean, I read somewhere the other day that the next iteration of Apple has already placed an order for 72 million of the next generation of iPhone. And I do think about this stuff, Scott. I look at these devices without which I couldn't be doing this broadcast, and without which most of us feel like, oh, Jesus, couldn't live. I mean, there's gold, and there's copper, and there's lithium, and there's God only knows how many things. And if you take a minute and you think down the capitalist supply chain, at the end of that road, somebody's getting fucked. In each and every instance. And also at the end of the life cycle, somebody's getting it as well. And it's probably some kid sitting on a massive mountain of our garbage, taking apart our old electronic crap. And that's not anything that you can build a human future on.
Well, a year or so ago, an insight hit me from way out of the cosmic blue, and I'll share it very quickly. Human suffering is neither noble or inevitable. It exists because we permit it to happen. Religious, political, and business forces encourage or allow it as it serves and furthers their ends, interests, and purposes. That, to me, is the situation in a nutshell. And it's a multi-pronged solution that has to be sought. It's not just getting rid of the undue influence, I think, of religious forces. It's not just about changing the minds and hearts of billionaires. It's not about educating the people who buy into the nonsense via right-wing talk radio and other media. It's not just one thing, I guess is what I'm saying. It's a combination of things. And it certainly didn't help years ago for radio to get deregulated and for the fairness doctrine to go away and for the equal time provisions to get watered down. And information is everything, okay? Well, hell, you know that. Your background is in media. People have a great capacity, I think, for dealing with truth and reality. But there's not a lot of that going around. I mean, this show and Malloy's show are two examples of where it is happening.
Well, at least in the United States. I don't know what they're talking about on the rest of the, in the rest of the planet. I'm guessing this kind of radio does not happen on a native basis in Iran or North Korea or China, but I don't necessarily know. Here's a thought experiment. I love these things because it means that I get to just come up with a question that I don't have an answer to, and we all look for one. If we look back to the era of our great-grandparents, or at least that's the era that I'm using, my great-grandfather was born in 1860, maybe 1855. His generation would have had A, no problem, and B, no objection to living like their great-grandparents. Because there, apart from a couple of technological changes, it was essentially identical. Take a person, say, 40 years old now, though, Scott, and ask that person to live like her great-grandparents. She's dead in a year. And I think that's a pretty profound difference. How many Americans could live like their great-grandparents did? How many so-called first world Europeans could live like their great-grandparents did? You know, the burgeoning rising middle class that we constantly hear about in China and India. They probably could because they're new to it. But the next generation, dead in a year. And that's one of the frightening things about not really putting all the skull sweat into climate change that we ought to be putting. Is this just crazy, or am I just a depressive who needs a Thorazine dart in the neck?
No, not at all. Or if you are, I'm right in line behind you. But I am old enough. I'll be 62 later this month. In the very early 60s, one of my great-great-grandmothers was still alive on my father's side. I'm not exactly sure that I would want to live the life that she lived, because she came over from the old country and she didn't speak much English. When we were little kids, we thought she was talking Martian. We had no idea that she was speaking a Slovak sort of language. But I have actual memories of her, even as a toddler, you know, a 6 or 7 year old. But yeah, that's a good point. I mean, my grandmother, her daughter, my great-grandmother's daughter, who was my grandmother, thought that things hadn't been right since we went to the moon the first time. And that's entirely possible. You know, what the hell do I know? She was born in like 1906. I know one thing she was right about. Chickens tasted better when she was a little girl. Okay? They weren't factory farmed.
Anybody who has access to fresh eggs will tell you that fresh eggs have a different and entirely better flavor than anything that comes on the truck into the grocery store.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend in northern Kentucky, just outside of Cincinnati, that has several chickens. And she raises those chickens and gets the eggs and takes them to the farmer's market. And I've never had one because she started doing this after I left the Cincinnati area. But yeah, that's absolutely true.
And see, the funny thing is, I wouldn't be any good at it because I'm getting older and I'm kind of broken down now. I had a grandmother who told me, you know, she saw the first airplane, the first time she ever saw an airplane fly over. And, you know, she was talking about standing in a place that's not 2 miles from here. And I'm pretty sure I knew who, I know who was flying the plane. But even my mother would tell me about what my great-grandfather's farm was like. And there was brutal labor involved. Farming ain't easy. But you know what? He lived up into his 90s, and he had his complete faculties about him when he died.
Yeah.
And he had, and you know, my mother would get kind of this glazed over look in her eye when she would talk about his apple orchards and his cherry orchards and his grape arbors and these peach trees and these plum trees and the spring house that was perpetually cool where he kept all of his dairy products. And the house was, by modern standards, a shack. And as a child, I was in it. And I thought it stunk. Maybe because it did. Because by then it smelled like home heating oil. And God knows how many years of wood fires. The stove ran on wood, not electricity.
What was that phrase you used to describe your current state of physical being? You're falling apart?
Broke down and falling apart?
Well, hell, you're younger than I am, so I don't I don't have a lot of hope for the future, except when I was a kid, I used to do magic, and there was a magic store over in D.C., and I would get on the bus and ride over to D.C. and buy magic tricks. Well, one day I was over there, and upstairs from the magic shop, there was a palm reader, and she read my palm for 50 cents, and she told me three things, one of which I've long ago forgotten. The other was I was expecting an important piece of mail, which I was. Of course, now at 9 years old, any mail is important. But the third thing she told me, and she's been right so far, is that I would live to be 89. So I'll be 62 later this month, so far so good. I've made arrangements in my will for one of my descendants or relatives to go over and see if they can find her to get my 50 cents back if I die before I reach 89.
Yeah. Track her down because there's a warranty on this. And when I say broke down and falling apart, what I mean is that I could not do at my age what my great grandfather, by dint of having done it all his life, did at his. I could not. Well, I don't know. Under the right circumstances, maybe we learn. But I could not get out and plow an entire field behind a mule.
No, no way.
I don't even know when to yell G and when to yell haw. I'd probably wind up three counties over by the time I figured it out. But I can damn sure put in a sumbitch of a garden if I've got a tiller.
Yeah.
But again, we're back to that gasoline-powered hydrocarbon, you know, thing. But I have a sneaking suspicion, Scott, that we had better, by God, start figuring out how. You know, there's still a good bit of land in the country. The problem is, like in West Virginia, vast tracts of it are owned by so-called land companies.
Yeah.
This place was at one time largely owned by settlers. But with the discovery of coal and the advent of the railroad, land agents came in. And brought a jug of liquor, and sat and poured shots for store bought liquor. You know, I mean, not that nasty stuff that, you know, great grandpappy made himself. And the next thing you know, he'd signed a broad form deed, and he was just selling off his minerals. But the next thing you know, he was getting run off the surface.
Yeah. Well, again, the moneyed bastards will screw you every chance they get.
And that's that's the story of America. That's the story of the expansion of the frontier. But it's a story that's going to have to change somewhere down the road.
Well, and where are you in the matter of the tipping point of 15 or 20%, and that there is some hope once we reach that in terms of consciousness and possibility seeking? What are our chances for convincing enough people, the regular folks like you and me, and also the moneyed folks? I mean, because they're not going to buy into the notion unless there's some money to be made.
Right. The moneyed folks, and I think Roselle was getting toward that as well, the moneyed folks won't jump in until they figure out a way to make a buck.
And see, that's the ironic thing. They could lose a fortune in oil and gas, but they could make a brand new fortune in terms of the new technology. And the insidious thing, Bob, is the fact of my statement that I made earlier. There's enough renewable resources on the planet to make, if you put them into dollars or some other form of money, to make every man, woman, and child the equivalent of a millionaire. And even if that happened, within a generation, the moneyed folks would figure a way, like your grandfather, or to screw them out of what they had.
That's capitalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, it becomes an Ouroboros. You know, it's a snake swallowing its own tail. Now, as far as coming to the consciousness needed to affect all of this change, Scott, what I was kind of getting at with Roselle is that it seems inevitable that the people who are going to have the worst part of it are the people who are A, doing the least damage, and B, least able to defend themselves. You know, so what if a few million peasants in India die? I mean, hell, they believe in reincarnation. They'll come back as a bug. They'll be fine, right?
Yeah.
And I don't say that because I believe it. I say that because that seems to be the operating mechanism of capitalism.
Well, individuals have no value to these bastards because the only possible value they might have is what they can transfer over to the money bastards.
But it's going to get really interesting when we lose Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, maybe D.C., Miami, Savannah, Charleston, Mobile, Biloxi, New Orleans, San Diego. Don't know about San Francisco. I mean, earthquakes notwithstanding. Certainly Seattle, Vancouver.
Maybe that's what they're waiting for, these moneyed bastards.
Well, that's where all their money is.
Maybe they're waiting for new fortunes in shoreline property to be waiting for them. But
there's damn sure a lot of land companies in West Virginia sitting on future beachfront property then.
Well, that's what I mean. Maybe this has been their plan all along. But they can't get the money until the new shoreline property comes into existence. And that can't happen until they forcibly fuck these communities that you listed a couple of minutes ago.
So, I mean, is that when we wake up? And again, you know, we watched New Orleans drown, but, you know, that was the wrong color people. But then Mike pointed out that we watched the same thing happen in New York. And, you know, okay, so, you know, we had the People's Climate March in New York. Apparently New York is serious about it. But what are we doing? And this is not to discount people who are doing something. Every solar panel matters. Every wind turbine matters. Appalachian Power, with its rickety coal-fired power grid, where I get my electricity, announced today that by 2018 they're going to bring 140 megawatts more of wind energy online, courtesy of a wind farm in Indiana. And that's, and again, I guess that's a good thing. And I'll probably wind up paying an unholy rate for it. But then the question obtains, why couldn't we save a few fucking mountains and put the wind turbines on them? It's got to be cheaper to transport the wind energy 40 miles than it is 500. No?
That makes sense to me. But then again, well, I was going to say land might be cheaper in Indiana, but a lot of that's good farmland. So I would think they would be better off putting these things on the mountaintops, because you can't really farm a mountaintop easily.
Tell that to the Inca people. Sure you can. But no, but I get your point. And you know what? Just because you've got wind turbines on your farm in Taliban, Indiana, doesn't mean you can't farm.
That's true.
Corn grows just as well around a wind turbine as it does without the wind turbine there. So that's why it is so attractive to farmers. Most of these wind turbines are on farms because they get a little bit more revenue. They get a lot more revenue out of leasing the land to put the wind turbines on.
Well, that's the same thing in Pennsylvania, where there's a lot of fracking going on, because that it's a source of income for the landowners.
Exactly, and you know, hey, look, capitalism. Hey, Scott, this has been a magnificent conversation, and I particularly enjoyed your input into it. But Punky's added a lot too.
Well, Punky always does, because he knows that it pisses me off. You're okay with it, but it pisses me off when he's not. I've been trying to catch him singing lovely and prettily, so that I can send you an MP3, because he does do something other than shrieking and squawking.
I don't take any of it as shrieking and I think if I spoke cockatoo or cockatiel, it would probably be downright trenchant.
Well, see, I've heard the good stuff that he does. He just does this when I'm on the phone talking to you, or hell, anybody for that matter. So, but I will pass along.
Well, one of these days we'll put the phone up to wherever his ear is, and I'll speak directly to him and see if it's just me that pisses him off. I mean, it would not be the first time.
No, I think it's me, because I'm not giving him the adequate attention that he thinks he deserves when I'm talking to you and all the fun lovers and truth seekers out there. But I've enjoyed it, Bob. I don't know if we came up with any answers, but we sure as hell gave people food for thought.
And that's the whole purpose.
That's why they call it conversation radio, even though when I call in, it's usually a rambling conversation, but sometimes those are the best.
They're always the best, because when they're all linear and Western and we've got to start with point A and eventually get to point Z, and no, when they wander, that's when stuff comes bubbling to the surface and we figure things out.
And who knows? Maybe we've inspired a couple of people to be part of the solution. Or shown them a way that they could facilitate that. So maybe it's all for the good.
Indeed, indeed. Scott, have yourself a good evening.
You too, Bob.
All right, say goodnight to Punky.
Good night, Punky.
Good night, Punky.
See ya.
Bye now. Down in San Diego, lovely. Well, let's see. What is it? Gloom in June? I have a hard time imagining San Diego as ever. gloomy. That's our buddy Scott. So we're 2 hours into the program now. We had $150 to raise this evening. We still have $150 to raise this evening. I despise talking about that, but it's the only way we solve the problem. Let's check in here. Make sure this will be our. This is a first time call. Are you there?
Hello.
Ah, there he is. This is our buddy Snork.
Sorry about that.
This is our buddy Snork, right?
I had the wrong sound on.
Oh, that's okay.
And I will turn you up.
It gets easier as you go. Is this Snork?
Yes, it is. Thanks for the call there. I wanted to talk a little bit about the relationship to real estate and solar and other alternative energies. One of the main problems that we have isn't so much energy. It's that we have a total lack of intelligent usage of how we're using our current energy. We waste so much, and our current structure of how we live in our day has not altered a lot in the last 100 years, except for that we're using more energy. The way we conserve our energy is worse than it ever has been. We might insulate a little bit, but we really need to be insulating a lot. And that our houses aren't set up for using the minimum amount of fuel. So if we go back and we look at, let's say, housing in New York, the buildings that were built in early 1900s that are still being occupied in slumlords do not have an efficient energy grid. We just waste all much. But if we were to say that's going away and we're to build new land, either we have to give large amount of money to the real estate people or we make their real estate worthless. Now, if we make their real estate worthless, these are people who know that they're having money and they're suddenly going to lose their asset that has been granting them all kinds of money. They are not going to be very happy with that, and they're going to fight it extremely. Just like when the radiation, the initial wave of radioactive iodine was hitting the United States from Fukushima, they did not have alerts because that would have just destroyed the dairy industry on the West Coast. If we said, well, some of that milk might be radioactive, it would have had repercussions all the way back through Wisconsin and wiping out the dairy industry. Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here. I'm listening.
Oh, okay. In reality, New York is always a day away from disaster. The water infrastructure for New York City, although they're currently trying right now desperately to get a second water source going for New York City, they have so much water that's used per day in New York City that it's drawn from hundreds of miles away through a cave that was lined with wood over 100 years ago. They have no way of inspecting the cave, and they have no way of repairing it if it's broken. So in one day, New York City could lose its water supply to a level where no toilets or anything could be flushable, or at least so few of them that it really wouldn't make a difference and people would not want to live there.
Well, it's not so much would not as could not, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we would be talking fecal-borne diseases in a very short period of time, mass death kind of diseases.
So which sort of ties in with something that I had on the list for this evening, since I'm just a little ray of freaking sunshine tonight.
But the people that live out in New York don't really need to be there. In the old days, it took 100 people for a bank to just write down the accounts every day. Things that used to be done with pencil and people doing their math in their head are now done in portions of a second with a computer. So the tens of millions of people to support the industry and all of the people that are necessary to support them no longer really need to be in New York City. They could be in North Dakota where there's ample water all the time, and that move could happen immediately. The thing is, that probably would not end up being a public purchase of land. That would probably be some government grant covering the construction of that material. But so the people who are collecting slum rent in New York City would lose their cash cow. They're not going to let that happen. So New York continues living on every day and actually creating barriers to people getting off of welfare by just making sure that they're living in these energy inefficient houses. There is no reason that we cannot take West Virginia and cover these areas that have been leveled with housing and an efficient infrastructure.
Well, actually, there kind of is a reason we can't do that.
Well, it's kind of toxic now, but that could be addressed.
Well, it's going to be it's going to be toxic for the next 100,000 years.
But not housing as you're thinking of it now. Right now, we have this thing in our head where everybody's got to have a house separated from everybody else, and there has to be a yard. You have to have your car, whatever. If we went in and sealed it, people could actually live on there. They would have to have they would have to have all types of issues. Almost putting a house in a fract or a area that has been mountaintop removed is almost as difficult as a moonshot. And it will take people to get stuff like this done. But we have to be thinking about, we need to rebuild all of our cities in to a manner that people can carry out their daily activities in a much less energy wasteful means. Personally, to me, the first step that we should be doing is a national sewer for moving all of our sewage to the sun states and in the desert Southwest. The desert Southwest has an abundance of sun and a lack of water. Majority of the other states have an abundance of sewage, and many of the states in the Northeast have an abundance of water carrying the sewage. The sewage, if it was taken to the desert states, could be converted into several types of algae. One of the types of algae makes the identical oil to what was what our oil began that we use make diesel and gasoline out of, and it's been tested in aircraft by the Pentagon and by Branson's Virgin Airlines, and both of them concurred that the biggest drawback of using their oil was it required less maintenance afterwards. So they ended up not being able to pay their maintenance people enough bonuses. It's better than the fuel. It's got no sulfur. And so there was no negatives. Transesterization changes this oil to gasoline if necessary. So immediately we could stop all drilling. No need for any fracking at all. In 2 years, we could be off drilling 100%. In 10 years, we could have completely replaced our infrastructure for coal and oil. That has some very negative aspects to it. What happens to the land value of people that bought land for oil exploration and speculation? It goes to zero. This hits them in the pocketbook exactly where they don't
want
to be.
And thus the problem is capitalism.
Right.
Meanwhile, something that you pointed out, I wanted to offer as an addendum. There are now at least, counting Flint, 33 cities in the United States, Snork, whose water is freaking poison.
Yes. Part of my graduate degree, I had to take industrial toxicology at the graduate level. One of my areas of expertise actually built water plants of a water that was so pure that it was capable of dissolving glass. We built a factory that could make that water 45 gallons per minute. And I have a very good understanding of water, and reading the reports that are available at every municipal water department, you have to ask for it. They will not show you unless you ask for it. But you can go down and ask them for their water report. In almost every city that I've been to, I would not drink the tap water.
Right, and what's coming out now is that in these various cities, Philadelphia being chief among them, not only is the water nasty, there has been, I hesitate to use a word like conspiracy, but there has been a conspiracy to dummy up the numbers.
Yes. Well, one of the things is when in any political office, you never want any negative news to come out, because anything that's found on your time period is blamed on your time period. So if you're the mayor when a city's determined to have radium water, it's your fault. In the Midwest, most of the towns have toxic levels of radium in the water, which is radioactive and may be a cause of many of our cancers and birth defects. A lot of people aren't aware, especially out in the East Coast area, in many of the areas where you frack, if you're getting flammable gas coming out of your faucet, you're also getting probably high levels of radon gas coming up with it as well, which is very bad for the lungs. It's very radioactive. Brain cancer, lung cancer, issues like that.
Oh, coal, in coal areas, coal itself has a radioactive component.
Yes. When coal was laid down, was at a time when there was a lot of volcanic activity. Material that the volcanoes gushed into the air had a large amount of uranium in it. So almost all coal puts out more radioactive waste than a nuclear plant. And if I could spend a moment on...
Welcome to Conversation Radio. Take all the time you need.
So many people are unwilling to talk about what should we be doing. We have so many people who are unemployed in the country right now. And we could be using all these unemployed people to be addressing all kinds of issues. We say we have money. Well, let's throw these people at it. One of my pet peeves is that we're not doing anything to repair the damage that we've done to the planet. We started killing whales 500 years ago, and we got really good at it. But we never understood what whales did for our production of oxygen for the planet. We always think of trees and plants as being our primary source of oxygen for the planet, and it wasn't. It was whales. Now, how does a mammal make oxygen? Well, it doesn't. But what a whale does is it dives deep. It dives really deep, and it eats big squid. And these big squid have been feeding on whatever's been feeding on, whatever's been feeding on stuff as it goes down and down and down and down. And so we have all these nutrients that settle down toward the bottom of the ocean. And a whale will take 45 minutes to go down there and get it. Once that whale has gone down there and eaten all these squid, that whale is trying to get to the surface in a hurry to get another breath so it can get back down. When that whale hits the surface, we're all familiar with soda beverages. Once they come to the surface, any air that's been in their stomach is bubbling. So whales, when they hit the surface, always have diarrhea. When they hit the surface, they spread out
who
the
knew?
Feces. They spread out the feces along the surface. A sperm whale can fertilize a square mile easily in just one surfacing. Now, when you think about, there used to be a lot of these creatures out there in the ocean. And if you look at the map or on a globe, you'll see that there's a little bit of land and there's a lot of water. Our planet is mostly water. So
just like our bodies.
And if you look at the portion of land that is in areas that can actually grow plants, it's very small compared to the amount of area that same sunlight goes over the ocean. So what happens in the ocean is that there are algae in the ocean that take the whale feces and turn it into oxygen. You know, that's their food. They reproduce and whatever, and they're taking in carbon dioxide. So majority of the world's carbon dioxide was always done by the algae in the ocean. When we killed the whales, we broke the whale algae cycle, and we've never repaired it. And one of the things we need to be doing right now is we need to get 2 billion people out there to replace the whales until their population comes back.
Time out. Who knew that there was a scientific background for looking at someone and saying, "By God, you're lower than whale shit on the bottom of the ocean." Are you suggesting two billion people need to go take a dump in the ocean?
Yes.
I thought the filthing up of the ocean was a problem.
Well, it depends on what the filth is. Properly treated and dumped for its nutrients into the ocean is the best thing we could do.
But I mean, there's poo and there's poo, Snork.
Yes, there is. That's why it needs to be treated.
I never much minded mucking out a horse stall, but I'll take a powder on where the on going anywhere the cattle are.
You don't really want to be swimming in that water.
No.
But that's what really a whale does.
What about the biological comparison between that of humans and that of whales?
Well, let me give you another view on it, just to really mess with your head. What if I said that amount of poo is already going into the ocean, but in an uncontrolled manner that is devastating to the ocean? Because it not only has to go in, it has to go in the right way in the right places. In the Gulf Coast right now, especially close to New Orleans, along there, each part of the year, they actually have too many nutrients flowing down because all of the cities still dump their waste from all the way from Minneapolis and North Dakota all into the river system that empties out right down there by New Orleans. And what happens is so much algae grows so fast and dies that it has this dead zone with no oxygen because of the algae rotting, because they grew too much in too small a location all at one time. It needs to be spread out and controlled. And what we need to be doing is controlling where our nutrients are in the ocean. And this is a concept that we never thought of, because our current model for water treatment in the United States is, let's start up at Minneapolis. They pump in their water from their wells. They treat the water. They take the solids out, or as many solids as they can. Many of them go out into farm fields and other applications that people don't even realize are being applied to their food. And the water from the toilets and whatever gets dumped back into the Mississippi River and goes on down to towns like Winona, La Crosse, Dubuque. And each of them, as they suck in the water from the Mississippi and pump back out their waste after treatment, it continues on as the rivers go south. So you cannot pull tap water out of any city that's along the Mississippi River, even if you think you're drinking from a well water that basically has not been from at least 50 other toilets.
Do you have any idea of what you're doing to a significant portion of the Horn family community congregation right now, Snork?
All of them that have glasses of the waters in their hand.
Reality spoken here, and science is science, and it's not dogma, and nobody cares whether you believe in it if it's, you know, real.
Yes, yeah. Water is a wonderful thing. It's one of the most cleanable substances that there is. It is so easy to clean that you can't believe it. Water that's been purified to its ultimate form has no difference where it came from. I would have no problem if somebody told me that if a certain grade of water had gone through certain treatment, that it came from a sewer or not.
I mean, that's a reality. But if you tell Los Angelinos that you're gonna come up with purified drinking water out of the sewer system, they go, "Huh, Jesus, no!" And then somebody somewhere in Beverly Hills or whatever will go, "Oh, but Muffy, why don't you know, if they want to frack down there in South Central, that'll be fine by us."
Yeah, but they
because they, I mean, while water is cleanable, there is some stuff you can do to water, at least as I understand it, from whence there is no coming back.
Actually, in large volumes, it depends on what level of treatment you're ready to put on it. For an affordable level, it comes to how much you're willing to pay. The one things you cannot take out of water is there. We think of water as H2O, and that's not reality. It's really hydrogen hydroxide, and sometimes it's not hydrogen that's on that water, because hydrogen has friends. They're called deuterium and tritium. Deuterium,
not very nice neighbors.
Right, is a form of hydrogen with an extra neutron in it. And when deuterium gets used as water and your body processes it, deuterium hydroxide, the ion gets substituted into your DNA. That DNA no longer unzips or no longer unzips properly. So diseases that have broken zippers in their DNA are going to result from that, if that gets in. You can and you do live from getting some deuterium atoms in your body all the time. You don't want it in high volumes, like what's dumped by a nuclear power plant or something. Same goes for tritium. You get tritium, some cell's going to die, or multiples. But water really is a very cleanable substance. The thing is, when you buy like a home RO system, 25% of what you attempt to clean is used to clean the system itself. So 25% of your water is lost and becomes dirtier. It basically says, this is going to be my clean batch and this is going to be my dirty batch, and separates it out. But the again, the water itself is extremely cleanable.
That's fascinating, because one of the things I remember scaring the daylights out of a lot of us back here was back when Joe Manchin, who never met a hydrocarbon that didn't give him a stiffy, wanted to build a coal gasification plant to make jet fuel for the Air Force. And the numbers we had were that it was going to cost something on the order of 5 gallons of fresh water to produce every gallon of gasified coal to, you know, fuel fighter jets to go bomb brown people. This did not seem like a good idea. But I have to compliment you, because the compliments are rolling in. I'm not complimenting you. Other people are. I just had a note from Carol Baker, Queen of the Minions, who said, what a great conversation with Snork. I'm smarter suddenly. And Brother Deacon Asa just said, the callers are off the chain today. And I love it. I love it when I have an opportunity. And I'm learning Snork, so thank you very kindly, because you're making you're making this process atypical to, you know, to for-profit broadcast media.
Because I couldn't do this on for-profit broadcast. You're honest.
Well, thank you. I used to get these emails from Ron and Raleigh, who would say, today on the Excellence in Broadcast, you know, can you imagine ever hearing this? Today on the Excellence in Broadcasting Network, a discussion of how we can save the planet with poo.
We have to.
When in fact, you know, Flush Flimbaugh, the oxymoron, is pumping poo across the people's airwave every day, and it's not doing anybody a damn bit of good. I got to share this with you, a note from Ron in the gradually warming north. Ron says, I sense an opportunity for capitalism to solve this crappy problem. Large, serviceable, but obsolete oil tankers are tied up all around the world. Load them with treated sewage, drive them out to those appropriate areas, and spray a full tanker load over a few hundred square miles. Pump in water to flush out the tanks on the way home, load up, do it again, lather, rinse, repoop.
Yes, I love it.
And I mean, it's why wouldn't capitalism get involved? Because what Ron's getting at there, and I think what you're getting at, Snork, is the exact opposite of something that already happened in the 19th century.
Yes.
Because in the 19th century, boats would load up, and it was largely the British were big on this. Boats would, and you know, there's no Panama Canal, so they got to go around the Horn. Great scows would load up with bird poo at the Galapagos Islands, sail all the way around the Horn, and it was literally dumped on Ireland to feed the potato crop.
Correct. In fact, it was so bad. I volunteered a few years back to bring some energy projects to an island group called Kiribati. And they literally lost their main island. England annexed them, took the top 200 feet off their island, and left it only 50 feet above water. And once the entire island top was removed and it looks like a moonscape, they gave them their independence back. So
yeah,
many
thanks for nothing.
Yeah, many of the Pacific islands, there are three types of islands in the Pacific. We have the islands, they're shield volcanoes like the Hawaiian islands. You have atolls that are basically collections of coral at the top of extinct volcanoes. And you have what are called guano islands, which are like an atoll that got covered by a cap of bird poop, and it became rocks over time. Anyway, a lot of the reef systems are full of calcium carbonate through the coral systems, which means that you have something that's like limestone. Now, wherever you see limestone used to be under an ocean. And also, wherever you find oil in the grade that can be used for fuel, all of the oil that comes from that is now what we're pumping for oil for fuel came from marine environments, not land. These are not former trees. They're not former dinosaurs.
They are not former dinosaurs, exactly.
These are marine algae of the exact type that I'm talking about that needs to be used in the sun states to be converting all of our sewage to fuel. And when it's done, it can still be used as nutrients for agriculture. Not only that, but we've cleaned the nastiness out of it, and we're not dumping the nastiness into the oceans anymore. Do we have a moment to talk about Oklahoma?
We have a moment to talk about anything you want to talk about.
We need to solve a lot of social issues, and one place that could really do a whole lot of help is Oklahoma. It's been devastated by oil wells. It's almost a landscape like West Virginia, where the things that we've done to it have made it almost impossible to live. And then they get the tornadoes.
And now it's Earthquake-ahoma.
Yes, earthquakes, tornadoes, toxicity. The worst of all the other states' problems are all right there. We should be using it for our example of how to set a state back right. Children should not be walking a mile home from school at risk of being in a tornado and then having their house blown away by a tornado. I would like to see Oklahoma converted to housing that is proper for its environment. Now, Oklahoma, especially the eastern side of it, sits at a dry air, moist air boundary that is like a tornado engine, that all types of energy is generated by the air that types there. The air that is there is optimum for actually extracting water from the air. And what Oklahoma really should be doing is the entire major portions of town should be underground, where The living is at a level where the storm can just blow over it, and people live in the safe area.
Once again, not an entirely new idea.
No, it's not. There's already
subsurface sod houses of the settlers of the plains, right?
And it's above ground. It's above the water plane, because where Oklahoma's kind of raised a little bit. There are floods in Oklahoma. I'm not saying that doesn't occur, but again, like as I mentioned with West Virginia, if we properly engineer it and we realistically understand what the problems we face are and we address them, we end up with good solutions. But first of all, I'd also like the national sewer system to be named after the only president worthy of a national sewer system.
The George W. Bush National Sewer?
George W. Bush National Sewer.
Absolutely.
Now,
I wanted to name the Bureau of the Public Debt after him because it's in Parkersburg, West Virginia. But in this case, I will defer to your idea, Snork.
Once you have an algae system in the deserts, we're taking sunlight, light that's heating the earth anyway, and we'll be turning it into something beneficial. If we were to have a 10-year store of our energy needs in sewage oil, we would actually have an enormous amount of captured carbon. Now, when you make a road, you send out heavy equipment that takes a lot of energy to dig up limestone. You pulverize the limestone. It takes a lot of energy. You heat the limestone to 2,000 degrees maybe. And you cook off the carbon dioxide, so you give off all kinds of carbon dioxide. It takes all of this energy to get the powder to make the concrete. And then it takes all the energy to move that concrete to where it needs to be used, and all types of energy to pump and move the water to where that concrete needs to be used. You end up using as much energy to make a road as all of the gas-guzzling vehicles that are going to ride on it. Now, there is an alternative. Using sunlight, there is a second kind of algae that produce what are called coccoliths, and they're little pieces of calcium carbonate. And you can actually cook those with sunlight and make concrete, Portland cement that way, instead of using all kinds of equipment to go out and burn through all of this energy to what it. So we end up using nothing but sunlight. And we only need a few counties of sunlight from the sun states to be able to process all of our sewage, produce all of our electricity and whatever energies we need, and we continue to waste it. These coccoliths can also grow in sewage, because the truth is the United States produces more sewage than we need.
And frankly, more than we can imagine.
Yes.
But it's interesting though that because I don't know how often anybody thinks about the life cycle of concrete or the production cycle of concrete, but to the extent that it started out as something alive back when before it was even limestone, it's a life cycle, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And what happens is we have two opportunities for everything. In my mind, I know I'm warped, in my mind, everything is either a cycle or a pipe. So we have the old whale cycle where the food hits the top of the water and it goes down and hits the whales. The whales bring it back up to the top, and the sunlight is the engine that keeps it moving. That's a cycle. A pipe, you put something in and you never get anything back out.
Because it's unidirectional.
Right. So we need to, if we want to be truly sustainable, there is no sustainability unless everything is a cycle.
Well, because that is the nature of the operating system that is the planet, and it's a closed loop operating system, right?
So if we were to stop mining, not just drilling for oil, but also mining for limestone, those two things together would stop us from wounding the earth so much, and start us back on a path to recovery, and. Again, we think of the energy we use, but reality, it should be the energy we waste that is what we're reducing first. then we start talking about where we come in.
Well, next. Absolutely. I mean, how much, and for that matter, how much coal-fired electricity that travels down the centralized grid, how much of that, one, you burn a ton of coal, you get the energy of a third of that ton of coal because it's horribly inefficient, and then you lose that over the a chunk of that over the transmission lines, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, you can also take sunlight, and you can take carbon dioxide from it, you can grow these coccoliths, and you can use sunlight to take carbon dioxide off of them that you can use to then grow more, better algae. And you're going to have some release into the air. But what's really nice about it is if you take this carbon, or if you take this calcium carbonate that's been changed into calcium oxide, you can ship it to places like Canada that still have snow and water in the winter, and you can actually just open them up, and they provide heat while they're absorbing moisture from the air, and you have a heat source that is recyclable. That when they're done, you can pack it up, put it on a train, let it go down to a sunny state, and it can be recharged by sunlight.
Astonishing.
And
so many
opportunities.
Okay, go ahead.
You do know some of my stuff. I do help companies, and you are no more than 1 foot from something I've touched.
Oh, my. I wonder what it is.
So, anyway.
Let me transition this, because if this country is cursed, and this country is cursed, Snork, it is cursed by two things. One, capitalism, but that seems to be a planetary curse. But we, you know, our politics are often our ruination.
Yes.
And the problem, and I'm not, for all we've talked about, I'm not pooping on your ideas. I had to. I'm sorry. I mean, you don't know what I'm looking at here. I got an email from Ron in Raleigh saying, Snork's ideas are great, but they would truly require us to get our shit together. You're bringing out the best and worst in the Horn family at one and the same time.
Humor gets more things done than anything else.
Carol Baker said, men with good minds give me a tingle up my leg a la Chris Matthews. Where has this guy been? So, that having been said, how does one accomplish these things?
Well, that's what we need you for.
Within the context of both capitalism and a political structure that worships money. I mean, is there a fortune, and I can't resist fun in a little bit either, Snork. Is there a fortune in poo out there?
There is. More than you can imagine. It's brown gold.
Well played, sir. Well played.
The thing is,
is there anything in what you're talking about that would cause the EPA to rend their clothing and sit in sackcloth and ashes?
They'd be worried about their jobs. Because most of what the EPA is fighting right now are the negative effects of not doing it. Because I'm out here in Iowa right now. You cannot imagine the stuff that's in our rivers and streams from the runoff from the confinement farms.
Oh, I can, because that's another thing Ron and Raleigh just brought up a couple of minutes ago, because Ron and Raleigh is obviously in North Carolina. He said, you know, we've got massive amounts of hog waste in North Carolina, and it is, and a lot of southern states and Mexico, and I can see a double whammy, process the hog waste, draw off the methane, treat the remainder, put it in the tankers, and the leftovers, treat the remainder, put it in the tankers and the leftovers from St. Ronnie's 600-ship Navy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can also put it in trains. Now, the nice thing about it is almost all trains can use the oil from this algae with hardly even transetherizing it at all. It can be used almost as it is in current diesel-powered trains, trucks, school buses, and ships, and generators. A lot of generators will run on this fuel. Now, that means that you could use your algae oil to supply trains, and basically as long as you have sunlight out in the desert being our energy source, you have a high-density fuel that is good for mobile vehicles to go out, come up to the and take a train load of stuff down there, get it processed.
How developed are these technology? I mean, are you talking about technologies that are deployable yesterday?
Right now, it's almost drop in. When I first saw it 10 years ago, I met a professor that was making his own coal from sewage. I mean, he asked the city, and the city would bring him 600 gallons at a time and dump off this horrible-smelling tote of raw sewage. And he started experimenting with what was the best algae for making coal. This is a drop-in replacement. I mean, you could probably take 3 to 4 years to build the factory and ramp up the supply system, because there's a distribution system that coal already has that we would need to swap out. But if you wanted to keep your coal plants and not have fracking, not have any of the mining, it within 4 or 5 years, his process would be replaceable. And the only thing that you would need is you'd need a lot more toilets in Virginia.
Well, when you consider the number of rural households where the straight pipe just still goes into the creek, and it is a significant number in West Virginia, at least.
What was really bad was before he did that experiment, he just went downstream from the pipe that was coming out of the municipal treatment plant, and was taking that.
And even that had enough in it that
to make coal. Well, it's not coal as you know it, but he processed a filamental algae, left it out in the sun to dry, and compacted it. And he got a very oil-rich substance that was cake form that you could just throw into anything that burns coal.
So it would be as opposed to yellow cake that we heard about during the run-up to the Iraq War, this would be brown cake.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, and can't resist.
Well, if you heat it, it looks like charcoal.
And so this is why you suggest we do this in the Southwest where there aren't any people.
Oh, it smells horrible. You could do it. You know, some of the other southern states, you could do it as well.
Well, I mean, it's not like it smells real pretty down next to Tar Heel, North Carolina. That's a fact.
In the lower parts of Carolina, in Georgia, some of those areas, there's a lot of days where it's not sunny, but you can still grow algae, and it would grow there as well, and they wouldn't have to transport it as well as far.
Could you do this in, say, I'm just thinking about previous human technologies.
Previous technologies have all had their drawbacks, and I'm certain.
You know what the Mexica people did in terms of expanding their arable land. What were they called? Chinampas?
Were those the ones that were in northern Mexico, where they basically?
It was in the valley of Mexico, around Lake Texcoco, where they would create floating rafts, and they would dump all of their waste on that, and that's where they grew their vegetables and so forth, their tomatoes, their chilies, what have you, and it eventually became land.
Mm-hmm.
So could you do this at sea?
Yes.
Where nobody would necessarily smell it?
You bet. In fact,
and it wouldn't necessarily bother the things that live in the sea.
It would benefit them, because let's say you also went as far as saying, "Well, if I'm going to start a processing center, I would basically probably build almost a floating city out there somewhere, And I would, you could have agriculture, whatever you need out in an area. It's what are you willing to work on and how much are you willing to put an effort in? But we're not putting an effort in right now.
What's the turnaround time on this on these processes?
Well, when Branson wanted enough for one 747 worth of fuel, that means that this was a plane that was in actual commercial use. This was a test that had made it to the point where they didn't have to have special passengers on board. They used regular passengers and flew with this fuel. And a 747 goes through a lot of fuel. And Branson's Virgin Airlines had a 747 operate on this fuel for a year. So the process is far enough along that it could supply not only Branson's plane with a complete supply of this fuel for a year, but also several United States Air Force large vehicles also ran their tests on it. So, it's just a question of ramping up that process if you're ready to go on commercial airliners, you're basically ready to ramp your process up to anything else. It's certified and ready to go on any.
But I mean the process itself. I mean, how long does it take to get the yield of a gallon? How long does it take for the algae to do their algae thing?
Typically to get 1 gallon of oil and retain your seed that you had will take about 6 weeks. So once you get past 6 weeks at a given volume, you're going to every day be putting out that same amount. So it's not like I make my entire batch and then I have to wait another 6 weeks to get it. It will end up being a constant flow out the other end, just as we all constantly flush our toilets.
Does it matter, for instance, that does all the other extraneous stuff that goes into our waste, the drugs we take, the toxins we take in, or are all these things converted by the algae?
No, there will be waste. There will be things that have to be separated out. But those things currently just are being filtered out by soaking into the stream beds around the whole country. So what it basically do is it'll bring them to the point where, hey, we're going to have to address this issue that we're not addressing now, but is going to be causing problems for our children for generations to come if we don't address it.
So we've had our little bit of fun as we talked about this, but it's a very serious topic. And mm-hmm. within the context of climate change, we really can't afford to take anything off the table that might help solve the problems.
No, we need as many solutions as possible as quickly as possible.
So here's the next question, because I never fully developed it previously. In a political system as dysfunctional as ours, I'm sure you can imagine the amount of tittering, if not outright guffawing, that would take place if, say, a president of the United States were to present this idea within the four corners of a State of the Union address.
It's never going to be able to come from them. This has got to come from the people. And that's why those of you with the microphones have to speak up. You can convert corn to ethanol. You can convert wheat to ethanol. You can convert potatoes to ethanol. But nobody ever goes hungry when you use sewage to make your fuel.
And it's the one thing that every human, alongside death and birth, it's the one thing that every living human being has in common.
Mm-hmm.
I forget who the author was who wrote, it might have been in the long term more helpful if there'd been a couple of verses in the Gospels talking about Jesus taking a good dump. we're having a national conniption snork over where people do this.
Mm-hmm.
When the fact of the matter is, it doesn't make much of a damn where they do it. They're going to do it, and there might as well be some good to be had out of it.
And the Romans used to have parties doing it.
I missed that one.
The Romans used to have group toilets.
They would party. No. They're at the bathhouse, yeah, and there was a sponge on a stick, and there was a stream of flowing water through the middle of the room. And that was, you know, in the age when paper was precious, a sponge on a stick was a lot more affordable, and nobody seemed to complain about using, you know, because there was, and I don't know, maybe the wealthy had their own sponges on their own sticks. But it is what it is. Yeah. But you're, I mean, so are there places that I or people or others can go and learn more and read more about all of this?
The first thing to anybody interested in is oil from algae. You can Google oil from algae. You can Google different types of marine aquaculture. One of the problems is getting a national interest in this. I'm poor at writing books myself, but I would love to see somebody that's prolific at writing actually volunteer to help me write a book on it. I'd love to.
Well, I think it's absolutely fascinating, and wouldn't you love to see a Bill McKibben just jump into this feet first? Although that analogy probably doesn't work well.
I'd love to see George Bush wade into it.
I'd like to see Donald Trump up to his hairpiece in it.
But it is a problem even trying to get anyone to take it seriously.
Oh no! Please don't mistake the fact that that we're having our fun along the way.
Oh no, it's got to be in fun. So many comedians are the ones to breach all of the major issues.
Maybe what you need, you know who the guy, you know, oh, I have one good idea a night or a day. I think I just had it. You know who you need to pick this banner up? John Oliver.
Oh.
This is a pick. Not Bill Maher. The second on my list would be Samantha Bee. But I mean, by orders of magnitude higher, John Oliver.
Yeah.
Because he would have massive amounts of fun, but as he has proven himself time and time again able to do, he would be able to make the seriousness of it shine through. Mm-hmm. But there are billionaires out there that one would think are into that kind of thing. Why? I mean, he wants to corner the market on water and wind. Why wouldn't T. Boone Pickens want to corner the market on poo?
Because you don't need to drill once you have. You can also make natural gas from this.
Yeah, but I mean, damn, Snork. And this is what I've never understood about the land companies and mountaintop removal in West Virginia. The land companies lease the land to the coal company, who blows the mountain up, gets the coal, makes a mess, leaves. The land reverts to the land company, who gives, well, goddamn, you know. And they've still got the land, and it's good for nothing anymore. Mm-hmm. Why are they so inexorably committed to one thing when they're fucking capitalists? And they should be, you would think that being capitalists, they want to make money at everything.
We aren't really a capitalist society.
I mean, you can
society,
charge for
though.
This stuff by the gallon, can't you?
Oh, well, we give it away for free.
And there you go. There you go. Well,
in fact,
we don't
give it away for free. We pay to have it taken away.
Well, ain't that the truth? Sometimes
I really appreciate you letting me.
You're welcome. You're welcome to bring anything that's on your mind to the table most anytime. I mean, that's That's why this program exists. So no thanks needed. The thanks are all in your direction, because I started out as just, you know, the little ray of sunshine, and talking about, you know, there's no thought leaders out there doing the kind of stuff that we've got to have done. And lo and behold, I did it. Well, even in the strangest places, answers can be found, can't they?
My most important takeaway, though, is nobody goes hungry when you use sewage to make fuel.
That's a bumper. And that's one of the other things you got to have. You got to have a bumper sticker. And that, Snork, is a bumper sticker.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to see John Oliver get in it. If anybody could polish this turd, it would be him.
Now, see, okay, I feel much better now. Whatever little jokes I made along the way, you just saw them all and raised them, so I'm all good now.
And it's if you talk to anybody about this, it's okay to tell Samantha Bee I'm single.
She's married, though.
Oh, bad news every day.
Well, you know, sometimes you find a diamond in the dung and sometimes you don't. My God, they just write themselves, don't they?
Yes.
Well, Snork, thank you so much, and I hope this will not be your one and only phone call.
No, I mean, if sometimes my speech can bore people to sleep, or, you know, because of my strange background, sometimes I give people nightmares.
Well, I'm wide awake, and I've got enough nightmare material. This is going to have to take a number.
Okay. I'll call back in again sometime then.
I hope you will, and I enjoy seeing you. I enjoy seeing you there in the chat room. You're welcome anytime. Thank you, Snork. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Have a good evening. Snork announced that he's from Iowa, and that immediately made Carol Baker's pink little ears perk up. And she said, I hear it. I hear it in his voice. He's singing the song of my people. So here we are at the end of the program. This seems like it has been a Jim Dandy one. I hope it has been for you as well. There's Randy in PA. Hush, little baby. Don't say a word. Pastor going to sell you a Jesus turd. High quality. Restaurant quality. Well, okay, not restaurant. I mean, I don't want to ruin anybody's dinner or lunch or breakfast or whenever you listen. I want to send out sincere thanks to Glenn. Glenn jumped in and proved to be the only funds we raised this evening. So tomorrow we will have a fundraising goal of $340. $340. As we go into Friday on the front porch. Thanks again, everybody. Have a wonderful evening. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thanks, John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, everybody.